Welcome to the Bulletin History Podcast, a quarterly presentation of the Public and Congressional Affairs Office of the U.S. Army Joint Munitions Command. JMC's mission is to provide conventional munitions for all U.S. military services. We currently manage 17 arsenals, depots, and ammunition plants around the country. But over the history of the Army, hundreds of installations have contributed to this mission. The goal of the Bulletin History Podcast is to tell the stories of our installations and the communities supporting them. We're not sure we can cover them all, but let's try. Please welcome your host, Dr. Paul Thomas Ferguson.
Thank you, Mark, for that introduction. Welcome, everyone, to Episode 2 of the Bulletin History Podcast. As you can already tell, if you listened to our first episode, we've made a few upgrades since then. As we think of other tweaks, we'll keep adjusting things and try to give you the best possible listening experience. If you have any suggestions along the way, please let us know. With that said, let's move on to our next excursion into history. For this episode, we move to Richmond, Kentucky, home of Bluegrass Army Depot. Bluegrass was established in 1941 in anticipation of U.S. involvement in World War II. It began operations in 1942 as a storage depot for ammunition and other supplies. In 1964, the installation merged with Lexington Signal Depot to become Lexington Bluegrass Army Depot. The facility in Lexington closed in 1999, since which time the Richmond site has operated as Bluegrass Army Depot. The closest community to the Bluegrass site is Richmond, located in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. Today, Richmond has approximately 36,000 residents, making it the third largest community in the Bluegrass region, after Louisville and Lexington, as well as the sixth largest city in the state of Kentucky. Long before it became host to Bluegrass Army Depot, Richmond was the site of one of the largest Civil War battles fought in the state of Kentucky. All told, there were 21 individual conflicts in the state during that war, of which arguably 13 were official large-scale battles. However you define it, the Battle of Richmond was among the most significant battles ever fought in Kentucky. More on that shortly. There are a few more historical bridges we need to cross before we burn that one. And like a true history nerd, I'm going to take you back to the very beginning. The lands in eastern Kentucky that would become known as the Bluegrass Region had been occupied sporadically for thousands of years before European settlement, let alone the arrival of the U.S. Army. The earliest known people to live in the Bluegrass region were Native Americans belonging to the Adena culture. This civilization flourished from approximately 1000 BCE to 200 BCE, an era known as the Early Woodland Period. Occupying a relatively confined area in the eastern Ohio River Valley, the Adena culture was an agrarian society, most noteworthy for its pottery, art, trade networks, and the construction of extensive earthworks. In particular, members of the Adena culture built hundreds of burial mounds, several of which still exist in Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, and even western Pennsylvania. The Adena culture was the predecessor of the Hopewell tradition, which moved into the Ohio River Valley from New York around 100 BCE, and became the most dominant culture in that region during the Middle Woodland Period, which ran from 200 BCE to 500 Common Era. Unlike the Adena culture, the Hopewell tradition was noteworthy for maintaining significant cultural interaction with numerous aligned tribal groups. Utilizing the continent's interconnected waterways, the Hopewell tradition expanded until its influence stretched from Lake Ontario to Florida. The Hopewell tradition thrived because of this extensive spread, which allowed the exchange of ideas and customs among more than 20 regional subsets of the culture, which themselves spread traditions of the cultures they had replaced. For example, the Ohio Hopewell culture, which occupied the territory we're discussing today, borrowed mound building from the Adena culture, and then added their own earthworks to the landscape. As a result, areas occupied by the Ohio Hopewell culture contained the highest concentration of mounds and ceremonial sites within the entire Hopewell tradition. Toward the end of the Middle Woodland period, changes in construction reveal increasing concerns about warfare within subsets of the Hopewell tradition. The number of large earthen mounds declined, while villages added defensive works like ditches and palisades, and trade with increasingly hostile groups declined. Comparatively little activity took place in eastern Kentucky from the years 500 to 1000, the late woodland period. This era saw cooler temperatures, which led some game to migrate south and west. The introduction of the bow and arrow likewise caused some areas to be overhunted while simultaneously making war more deadly. This required significant changes if the descendants of the Hopewell tradition were to survive. Some of them dispersed, following game migration. Others built fortifications around small population centers, abandoned significant building projects, and experimented with agriculture that was more permanent, particularly the planting of squash, beans, and maize. The last pre-Columbian people to inhabit eastern Kentucky were members of a culture known as Fort Ancient. The Fort Ancient people, who lived between 1000 and 1750 Common Era, occupied the same lands previously held by the Edina and Ohio Hopewell cultures, and may have descended from those groups, though historians have not reached a consensus on that point. The Fort Ancient people introduced agriculture to Ohio as early as the year 1000. At this point, their villages consisted of 40 to 50 people from a few dozen nuclear families. Although these early villages were occupied year-round, they were not permanent, lasting only a generation or two before being forced to shift to new lands and new reserves of game. By the year 1200, villages held up to 300 people and lasted perhaps 25 years before exhausting area resources. The Fort Ancient culture also reintroduced mound building. While some of these structures followed prior traditions by serving as burial sites, other Fort Ancient mounds were constructed as effigies, in the shape of people or animals, serving religious and ceremonial purposes outside of burial. Village construction also held ceremonial significance, with buildings arranged in alignment with the solar calendar and platforms constructed for the purpose of religious ceremonies. The remains of Fort Ancient villages and earthworks exist throughout Ohio, West Virginia, and eastern Kentucky. Many such earthworks dot the landscape between the Lexington and Bluegrass Depot sites. The most recent of these date from around 1550. By the year 1400, scattered groups of Fort Ancient peoples began to coalesce and settle into larger communities, with up to 500 people each. These larger villages, and the palisades surrounding them, reveal a renewed emphasis on defensive works, presumably in response to rising threats. There is also evidence at this time of increased contact with the Mississippian culture from the lower Ohio River Valley. After about 1550, the Fort Ancient culture went into decline, along with many other native populations in the area. Though the Ohio River Valley groups had not yet come into direct contact with European explorers, they did encounter European diseases transferred to them by more wide-ranging native cultures. The result was a significant decrease in population and a power struggle by survivors who formed distinct tribal designations. This was a nightmare scenario for the future survival of native populations in the region, one which European explorers and settlers quickly exploited. The first modern native population to call Kentucky home was the Shawnee Nation, one of several Algonquian tribes scattered between the Middle Atlantic and Canada. The Shawnee likely originated in New England and the eastern Great Lakes, spreading from Pennsylvania to Illinois and from Maryland to the Carolinas in the 17th century. One of the earliest mentions of their presence comes from a Dutch map of the Delaware region dating from 1614. By the middle of the century, French explorers likewise documented Shawnee settlements on the Ohio River, and the English encountered them at Charlestown, South Carolina, in 1674. Throughout the late 17th century, direct contact with Europeans, along with additional pressure from the Iroquois in the northeast, led to a century-long conflict known as the Beaver Wars. This protracted struggle was at heart a fight over the fur trade. On one side stood the Iroquois League, supported by allies England and the Dutch Republic. On the other side stood France, supported by allies from every native tribe hostile to the Iroquois. The breadth of this war, along with the increasing power of the Iroquois and incursions by Europeans, forced the northeastern Shawnee to disperse. Some moved south to settle among their brothers in the Carolinas, but most crossed the Appalachians to settle in the Ohio River Valley between West Virginia and Illinois. Although they had access to a seemingly vast territory, the Shawnee established their largest concentration of villages in a narrow swath of central Kentucky and Tennessee, between the Ohio and Cumberland River valleys. Meanwhile, the Iroquois, Huron, Uchi, and Cherokee all hovered at the edge of Shawnee lands, using areas of both eastern and western Kentucky as their hunting grounds. Because of this, by the dawn of the 18th century, Shawnee fortunes in the region were uncertain. The Cherokee and Chickasaw formed an alliance and moved against the Shawnee from the south. This pressure forced the Shawnee to abandon their Cumberland Valley settlements. In 1714, a French trader reported that the Shawnee had abandoned many settlements in the vicinity of present-day Nashville and had withdrawn north toward the Ohio River. Some of these emigres were responsible for the establishment of a settlement near present-day Shawnee Town, Illinois. But most moved into central Kentucky, concentrating in the Bluegrass region. During this migration, at a spot midway between the future sites of the Lexington and Bluegrass depots, Chief Katakahasa, or Blackhoof, was born around 1740. Katakahasa later became an important Shawnee leader during both the French and Indian War and the War of 1812. He would also fiercely resist U.S. government Indian removal policies until his death in 1831. Although the general location of Katakahasa's birth is known, nothing remains to mark the site because the constantly in motion Shawnee used temporary settlements instead of permanent villages. It is telling that many of these settlements bore what was essentially the same name, variants of which included Taiwapita and Taiwapiti. These names, which mean place to which we may not return, suggest that the Shawnee considered their forced migration to be ongoing and unlikely to stop anytime soon. Southwestern bands of Shawnee continued to make their way northeast, even as their Carolina cousins, also at war with the Cherokee, moved north into Pennsylvania. These two branches of Shawnee eventually merged in the Ohio region around 1750, reuniting for the first time since being divided during the Beaver Wars. The story of early European settlement in Kentucky is well known and centers on one person, Daniel Boone. Even today, eastern Kentucky abounds with tales of Daniel Boone, so much so that it can be difficult to tell fact from fiction. Although the emphasis on this pioneer might sound forced, it is justified. Daniel Boone was one of the first men of European descent to lay eyes on the region. In 1767, he and his brother crossed the Appalachians into Kentucky, though they didn't descend into the area at that time. In May 1769, Boone, with four companions, reached Pilot Knob and saw the Bluegrass region for the first time. Despite frequent skirmishes with the native population, Boone's party spent the winter of 1769 and 70 north of Indian Fort Mountain, which is near present-day Berea. In 1770, the group explored the region that would later be home to Richmond and Lexington, spending their second winter just west of the site of the future state capital. In 1773, Boone attempted to migrate into Kentucky with several families, but when natives attacked their party, killing several, including Boone's eldest son, the settlers called off the excursion. Despite this setback, he didn't give up. In 1774, at the request of John Murray, 4th Earl of Dunmore and Royal Governor of Virginia, Boone returned to Kentucky on a mission to warn settlers and surveyors near Harrodsburg, 20 miles southwest of current Lexington, about potential Native attacks. While in Harrodsburg, Boone bought land and built a cabin, becoming an early resident of Kentucky's first European settlement. 1 year later, Boone led a large party of settlers through an Appalachian mountain path, later known as Boone's Gap, establishing a formal pack trail to the west. His party then started building what would become Fort Boonesboro, southwest of Lexington, the second oldest European settlement in Kentucky. This accelerated the speed of settlement in the region dramatically. During this time, the Shawnee made several attempts to stop the encroachment of settlers, but with little success. In mid-1778, despite several months spent personally living among the Shawnee, Boone led a group of settlers in preemptive attacks against the tribe. In response, the Shawnee besieged Boonesboro in September 1778, only to see Boone rally his forces to relieve the town and break the siege. Native raids and ambushes increased after 1780, claiming the lives of at least 2,000 more Kentucky settlers by the time the region achieved statehood in 1792. Yet, Native opposition to settlement in eastern Kentucky was never again as organized as it had been at Boonesboro. For the next 70 years, settlement in the Bluegrass region increased dramatically as new arrivals transformed Kentucky land into cattle ranches, thoroughbred horse farms, and tobacco plantations. This would become the setting for one of the largest conflicts to take place in Kentucky during the American Civil War. On the eve of the Civil War, Kentucky was in a unique position among the states. Although a slave state, with a population nearly 20% of which was in bondage, the residents of Kentucky were of two minds on the subject. This reflected the state's physical location, wedged as it was between the ideologies of its neighbors. To the north and northeast lay the free states of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, along with the pro-Union region of Western Virginia, soon to become West Virginia. To the southeast, south, and west lay the slave states of Virginia, Tennessee, and Missouri. In 1860, Kentucky did not have a strong, single political identity. Boasting a long list of native-born national figures, including Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Henry Clay, and two vice presidents, the state was politically split, with former Whigs, pro- and anti-slave voters, pro- and anti-immigrant voters, all supporting a variety of political parties. In fact, presidential candidate John Bell would win Kentucky, Virginia, and his native Tennessee for the Constitutional Union Party in the 1860 election. The governor of Kentucky at this time was a man with the unlikely but absolutely real name of Beriah McGoffin. The governor supported Confederate views concerning states' rights to determine their own rules, especially regarding slavery. However, McGoffin did not support secession. In fact, he wrote to the other southern states, begging them to reach a compromise that did not involve leaving the Union. With the outbreak of the Civil War in April 1861, Kentucky suddenly assumed strategic importance for both the Union and the Confederacy, due to the location of the Ohio River on its northern border. Both sides knew whoever controlled navigation on the Ohio would have a distinct advantage in the war. McGoffin attempted to call a vote concerning secession, but the pro-Union assembly declined to meet, out of fear that the populace would vote to join the Confederacy. When President Lincoln called for Kentucky to provide 75,000 volunteers for the war, McGoffin refused, agreeing with both houses of the General Assembly to declare neutrality for Kentucky. The Union and the Confederacy both respected Kentucky's neutrality publicly, while establishing forts and bases of operation in Ohio and Tennessee in anticipation of the state becoming a battleground. Meanwhile, thousands of Kentucky residents volunteered to fight, some for the Union and some for the Confederacy. While significant numbers of cavalry would join the Confederate side, Kentucky infantry regiments supporting the Union would outnumber those supporting the Confederacy 60-9. The Kentucky state government tried to protect itself by calling up volunteers to secure the borders, but these units quickly divided into pro-Union and pro-Confederacy factions. The situation changed with the election of June 1861, when pro-Union candidates won 9 out of 10 congressional seats. The only Confederate win was the far western tip of Kentucky, which was intellectually and economically aligned with Tennessee and Missouri. The August 1861 election for state legislators continued this political shift, giving pro-Union candidates a 76-24 margin in the House and a 27-11 margin in the Senate, numbers which gave Governor McGoffin a veto-proof opposition. The Confederacy was the first to violate Kentucky's neutrality. On September 4, 1861, Major General Leonidas Polk occupied the border village of Columbus, Tennessee, established a fort there, called Fort DeRussy, and started making incursions into the pro-Confederacy region of Kentucky, while also attempting to block traffic on the Mississippi River. In response, Union Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant crossed the Ohio River into Paducah from Cairo, Illinois. Kentucky had officially become a battleground state. Governor McGoffin demanded the withdrawal of forces from both sides. The assembly responded by calling for only Confederate troops to leave. McGoffin issued a proclamation of neutrality again. The assembly ordered the Union flag to be raised over the Capitol. Back and forth, back and forth. Confederate sympathizers met in Bowling Green in November 1861 and created a shadow secessionist government with a new governor because McGoffin refused to support what he considered an anti-democratic body. This version of the Kentucky government was admitted as a Confederate state in December 1861. Though part of the Confederacy throughout the war, it mainly existed on paper and had little influence on the events that followed. The first significant conflict in Kentucky was near the Tennessee border south of Richmond, at the Battle of Mill Springs in January 1862. There, adverse weather and organizational confusion on the part of the Confederacy led Union General George H. Thomas to victory over Major General George B. Crittenden's forces, whose field commander, Brigadier General Felix Zollicoffer, had been shot and killed during the battle after mistakenly joining a regiment of the Union infantry. More significant were the subsequent battles at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson, which took place on the western half of the southern border. These critical installations on the Tennessee River fell to Grant on February 5th and February 15th, 1862, forcing the Confederate Army to abandon western Kentucky, retreating from Columbus first to Bowling Green, then to Nashville, Tennessee, and finally to Corinth, Mississippi. Between February and August 1862, the most significant activity in Kentucky came at the hands of Confederate cavalryman John Hunt Morgan, who conducted raids throughout the state, disrupting Union supply lines and destroying villages along the Ohio River. Morgan's raids improved secessionist morale enough to prompt Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith to organize a formal invasion of Kentucky, under the assumption that success would encourage supporters throughout the state to volunteer to fight for the cause. The plan called for Smith to move against Union General George W. Morgan, whose forces guarded the Cumberland Gap. After beating Morgan, Smith would proceed to Nashville, while General Braxton Bragg joined him from Chattanooga. This combined force would then take Nashville from Union troops under Major General Don Carlos Buell before invading Kentucky. The problem with this scenario was that none of it went as planned. General Smith moved against Morgan at the Cumberland Gap only to reach a stalemate. Eager for action, Smith abandoned his siege as well as the planned Nashville campaign in favor of invading eastern Kentucky. And he did so on August 13th. In response, Bragg moved north from Chattanooga on August 27th, bypassing Nashville to invade central Kentucky. Their collective actions led to several important battles in this stage of Kentucky's war. The first, largest, and most successful from the Confederate perspective was the Battle of Richmond, fought on August 29th and 30th, 1862, on and near the site of the future Bluegrass Army Depot. Under Smith's command, Confederate forces moved north from Tennessee to meet Union forces under Major General William Bull Nelson at Richmond. Nelson's commanders there were Brigadier Generals Malin D. Manson and Charles Cruft, supported by cavalry under Brigadier General James S. Jackson. Wanting to meet the Confederate Army on better defensive ground, Nelson ordered Manson and Cruft to withdraw to Lexington, but they either didn't receive this order or they ignored it, because instead they moved south from Richmond and established a line across the Richmond-Kingston Pike, also known as Old State Road, near the Rogers House. After minor skirmishes on August 29th, the two armies met on August 30th, 1862, near Mount Zion Church. Leading Confederate forces on behalf of Smith were Brigadier Generals Thomas J. Churchill and Patrick R. Cleburne, supported by cavalry under Colonel John S. Scott. Cleburne's seven regiments formed two lines on the east side of the pike, opposite four regiments with which Manson had advanced. Cleburne attacked the Union position on the morning of the 30th. As the battle progressed, Manson used reinforcements to bolster his left flank, not realizing that Churchill was secretly approaching the Union right with five regiments, using a deep ravine to block their movements. When Churchill's forces emerged, Manson saw the danger and ordered his men to pull back to the Rogers House, which temporarily became the center of the Union defense, with the assistance of four regiments under Cruft. After a brief effort to hold this new line against the systematic advance of the Confederate Army, Union forces steadily withdrew north along the 8-mile stretch leading to Richmond. There, Nelson formally took charge of Union defenses, while Smith likewise arrived to guide the Confederate attack. Nelson set up a line at Richmond Cemetery, but his men were soon overwhelmed, broke, and ran. Nelson tried to rally his troops, but the Union men were in full frantic and disorganized retreat. Seeing that all hope was lost, Nelson fled the battle as quickly as he could, leaving his men to fend for themselves. The Battle of Richmond was the largest Confederate victory in the state of Kentucky, and one of the most complete Confederate victories in the entire war. The numbers tell that tale. While total Confederate casualties were just 451, the Union suffered 5,353 casualties, over 4,300 of whom were captured during the flight from Richmond, among them General Manson. Manson would be returned in a prisoner exchange after 2 months, and would go on to command the 23rd Corps during the Knoxville Campaign, as well as a brigade of the Army of the Ohio during the Atlanta Campaign. After this Union defeat, Confederate forces were briefly able to carry the war into the interior of Kentucky, but would be forced to retreat from the state by 1863. As we wind down this brief look at eastern Kentucky, you might appreciate a short history of the building utilized as a stronghold by Union forces during the first two phases of the Battle of Richmond, the Rogers House. This Federal-style home was built by Adam Rogers in 1811, then purchased in 1858 by Alex Tribble. Though most locals still referred to it as the Rogers House at the time of the battle, it has since then been called the Rogers-Tribble Home. During Phase 1 of the Battle of Richmond, Federal troops had used the home as a staging area before engaging Confederate forces south of the property near Mount Zion Church. During Phase 2, when those same Union soldiers were forced to retreat from the Confederate advance, they briefly rallied near the house, where they met the heaviest fighting of the battle. In the process, the Rogers-Tribble home became a de facto Union field hospital. As Union forces retreated to Richmond, where they would meet ultimate defeat, they had no choice but to leave the house and its occupants in the hands of the enemy. Following the battle, the Confederate victors continued using the house as a field hospital for several weeks, with Union doctors remaining at their posts, serving both Union and Confederate casualties. The Rogers-Tribble home changed ownership many times before 1942, when the U.S. Army acquired it as part of its plan for Bluegrass Army Depot. Designated as Quarters 29, it served first as the commander's quarters and later as bachelor officers' quarters. In 2000, the Army vacated the house and it remained unoccupied for 5 years. Then in 2005, In recognition of the historical importance of the property, the Army de-accessed the home and transferred it to Madison County. After extensive renovations, the structure reopened to the public as the Battle of Richmond Visitor Center in 2008. It contains numerous exhibits and Civil War-era memorabilia, as well as an interactive map of the battle. The numerous historical markers on and near Bluegrass Army Depot also pay tribute to the region's colorful past. One final curiosity. Among those battlefield doctors laboring at the Rogers Triple Home at the Battle of Richmond was Captain Bernard Irwin, a Union physician who stayed throughout the engagement, tended the wounded as a prisoner after the battle, and later brought medical supplies from Cincinnati to voluntarily continue ministering to the casualties from both sides. Irwin already had a reputation by then, though. In February 1861, he had led a successful rescue mission, recovering 14 captured soldiers from an Apache band led by Cochise. Irwin would eventually receive the Medal of Honor for these actions in 1892, even though the award had not yet existed at the time of the events. As a result, Bernard Irwin, future Civil War doctor and eventually senior medical officer at West Point, ranks first among the 3,520 Medal of Honor winners so far recognized, when listed chronologically according to the date of his actions. As I said, a curiosity, but just one of many, as we'll see in future episodes.
The Bulletin History Podcast is a quarterly presentation of the Public and Congressional Affairs Office of the U.S. Army Joint Munitions Command. Research, writing, and presentation by Dr. Paul Thomas Ferguson. Music by the Perpetual Notions. Announcer, Mark Kane. Thank you for listening. We hope you join us for our next episode. Until then, we're history.